it's the double whammy of the false promise and the website that is causing a lot of angst. And that may be very difficult to recover from.
This week, the media pounced on the president's oft-repeated claim that no one will take away your health insurance. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A journalist has her notes confiscated when DHS searches her property.
The search warrant that they presented was to locate a potato launcher or a potato gun. Basically, it's a novelty item.
Also, the fabled first broadcast of the War of the Worlds may not have been as explosive as we've been led to believe.
If you were to make a documentary today about the Civil War or the Jazz Age, don't you think you'd use newer scholarship than from 1940?
All that and much more after this.
Hi, Brooke.
Hello, Katya Rogers, our senior producer. I know why you're here.
Well, it's Friday afternoon. We've just finished the show. It was extremely hard work, as it is every week, and we're almost dead. And
it's the end of a pledge drive.
And it's the end of a pledge drive. And we need to say thank you to everyone who's given, who make this possible. The other thing we have to say is, for the rest of you...
There was some strategy that you really liked that Ira said.
Oh, you know... Come on, stop making me bother you, you know? Like, we're all grown-ups. We know nothing comes for free. We really have to just bite the bullet and pay for it because it doesn't exist otherwise. I mean, basically, that's his message, isn't he? Just a whiny nudge.
Yeah. That's the way Ira puts it. I mean, it's pretty simple. It's ridiculously simple. It's almost simple-minded. Come on.
That's it. That's whiny and nudgy.
You think that'll work?
Yeah.
Please, come on.
Please. Enough.
And thank you.
Oh, yes, and thank you.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Another week, another round of troubles for President Obama and his Affordable Health Care Act. This time, the focus was on his claim, repeated endlessly.
If you like your plan, you can keep your plan.
We learned definitively this week that that was so wrong.
In Los Angeles, that isn't what Deborah Cavallaro is finding.
Here's Monday's NBC Nightly News.
A self-employed realtor, she buys her own insurance. Cavallaro's provider recently sent her this notice, reading, because of the requirements of the new laws, we can no longer offer your current policy.
The report went on to reveal a smoking gun.
That millions will lose or have to change their individual policies is not a surprise to the administration. NBC News senior investigative correspondent Lisa Myers found buried in the 2010 Obamacare regulations language predicting a reasonable range for the percentage of individual policies that would terminate is 40% to 67%.
To add insult to perjury, New York Magazine even produced a supercut of the dozens of times the president has made the claim over the past few years.
If you like your current insurance, you will keep your current insurance. If you like your plan, you can keep your plan.
If you're happy with what you got, nobody's changing it.
Glenn Kessler writes the Fact Checker blog for the Washington Post, and this week awarded the administration's claim that no one will take away your health plan four Pinocchios, the rating reserved for real whoppers.
I could kind of understand if he said it while the bill was being negotiated as a kind of an aspirational effort. But then he kept saying this, even as his government was providing statistics and information that was making clear that that pledge was really not sustainable.
Now, it's a lie, but it's kind of a lie with an asterisk. Because, yes, as it turns out, the government can compel you to change your insurance, but only if it doesn't meet certain minimum standards for coverage. So whatever you are compelled to replace it with is going to be better. So it's not quite as egregious a lie, right?
It was rather unequivocal. If you like your plan, you can keep it, period. I mean, it would be fine if he had said, there are a bunch of plans out there that really aren't good for you, and we're going to actually give you better plans that work more for you, and you're not going to be stuck in those bad plans. That wasn't what he said. So now we're at the moment where, as one of my colleagues put it, the soundbite bit back, because now they're actual victims that TV can focus on, people holding up notices saying their insurance had been canceled.
Is that how the press should operate, to have to wait? Now it's, you know, 5 years into this process, to have poster children in order to get to the root of a story?
Let's face it, healthcare is a very complex subject. And a lot of this coverage is TV coverage. TV coverage in particular likes to have a victim. The estimate that I saw was that probably about 9 million people are going to end up having to pay higher premiums and coverage they didn't really want. Well, that's 9 million potential anecdotes that now the media can bring up.
Can you think of anything the administration could or should have done in selling this plan and in talking about it low these last 5 years to render their claim Pinocchio-less?
What the administration needed to do was be more honest about the fact that some of the plans out there they believed were substandard were a ripoff for the American taxpayer, and they were going to make sure those plans disappeared. One of the other reasons why I gave the claim for Pinocchio's is that one reason why a lot of plans are disappearing right now is because of the specific way the administration wrote the regs in order to force the disappearance of these plans. And there are some people out there that like the idea that they were buying a bare bones policy, not paying a lot of money, but if they were hit by a truck, they would be covered in some way. That option is really disappearing in the Affordable Care Act.
Clearly, the administration believed that it accrued political advantage by saying, don't worry, don't worry, don't worry. Can the political advantage of having done that to calm the public down over the last 5 years possibly compensate for the uproar that it has to deal with now that people realize they've been sold a bill of goods?
I mean, the reason why they were making those statements was, of course, they were fighting the last war, which was the effort under the Clinton administration to pass healthcare reform. During that battle, the opponents successfully made people believe that they're going to lose their plans. So this administration decided, we're going to deal with that by saying, you're not going to lose your plans. Now, they might have been in a better position if the healthcare website was working and some of these people who are getting cancellation notices could actually go on the website and discover, well, gee, this is not a bad deal after all. But they're not able to do that. So it's the double whammy of the false promise and the website that is causing a lot of angst. And that may be very difficult to recover from.
Glenn, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Glenn Kessler writes the Fact Checker blog for The Washington Post. He is the dispenser of Pinocchios.
While we're on the subject of government misdirection, let's consider the number 54, otherwise known as over 50 or dozens. Back in June, after the first of Edward Snowden's NSA leaks were published, NSA Chief General Keith Alexander testified before Congress about the success of its surveillance program.
In recent years, the information gathered from these programs provided the U.S. government with critical leads to help prevent over 50 potential terrorist events in more than 20 countries around the world.
President Obama echoed that statement that same week while on a visit in Germany, with Angela Merkel by his side, and no doubt before she knew that her own phone was being surveilled, Obama made the case for the importance of the program.
We know of at least 50 threats that have been averted because of this information, not just in the United States, but in some cases, threats here in Germany.
Eventually, the over 50 transformed into the more specific 54. At the end of July, Congressman and chair of the House Intelligence Oversight Committee Mike Rogers went on CBS's Face the Nation, where he told Bob Schieffer,
"That's a pretty impressive record. Zero privacy violations, 54 terrorist attacks that saved real American lives and our allies as well. That's real success."
Some went a step further, like Representative James Lankford at a town hall meeting in August.
So that's been used 54 times to be able to interrupt 54 different terrorist plots here in the United States that had originated from overseas in the past 8 years. That's documented.
54 attacks here in the United States. The NSA itself didn't even make that claim. In September, NSA Chief Alexander testified before the Senate, where he offered a more nuanced explanation of the program's success.
NSA's programs have contributed to understanding, disrupting 54 terror-related events, 25 in Europe, 11 in Asia, and 5 in Africa, and 13 in the United States.
Contributed to understanding. Not exactly the same as prevented or thwarted. ProPublica's Justin Elliott says that the notion that the NSA surveillance program has thwarted 54 terrorist attacks has been picked up and spread largely unchecked by media and members of Congress.
Some outlets did better than others, but often the original sort of heavily qualified version, this surveillance has contributed to our understanding of 54 terrorist-related activities, often those qualifications would fall away and the media version would just become these surveillance programs thwarted 54 plots.
You call it a zombie assertion.
Right. If one was going to be cynical, from the NSA's perspective, you could expect that this would happen. This very carefully worded statement that's a 35 or 40 word sentence that Keith Alexander originally came out with in June, you know the media is not going to be able to handle that and it's just going to become 54 attacks thwarted by NSA surveillance.
You say that the AP was actually an exception to this rule.
Yeah, the AP, to its great credit, did an excellent story when the NSA came out and said, here's an example of one of these cases. And the example had to do with a plot to attack the New York subway system back in 2009, which everyone agrees was an actual real terrorist plot. They're citing this case to defend some of this new surveillance that you can do without a warrant. The AP did a close fact check of that claim, and they said, look, it may be true, as the NSA says, that these surveillance programs helped. But on the other hand, no judge would deny you a warrant to surveil an al-Qaeda email address. So arguably, that's not a particularly good defense of this new warrantless program.
What prompted you to write the story you did about the number 54 was because of an event that happened on Capitol Hill. It was during a hearing.
Senator Patrick Leahy was questioning Keith Alexander, the head of the NSA.
Would you agree that the 54 cases that keep getting cited by the administration were not all plots, and other 54, only 13, had some nexus to the U.S.? Would you agree with that, yes or no?
Yes.
Patrick Leahy has seen the full list, and he's actually gone further and said not only are the 54 quote-unquote events not all plots, the NSA surveillance did not play a significant role in all of these events.
We have this number. It has become something of a fixture. It's a zombie eating our brains. And what do you want the media to do about it?
I understand why, if Keith Alexander goes out there, or certainly President Obama goes out there and makes this claim, you're going to quote it. I mean, that's what you should do. I think it's reasonable to do two things after that. One is to ask for evidence that it's true, which some outlets, to their credit, have. And the next thing is, if that evidence is not forthcoming, to add a sentence that says the NSA has not substantiated this claim. And in this case, I would go even further and say, in the 4 cases out of the 54 that they have detailed, this is what we know, and frankly, those examples are rather weak.
What do we know about those 4 examples?
One of them is the New York subway plot.
Which could have been foiled, you think, with a simple warrant.
Right, according to the AP's analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is a case of a guy, Basali Moalan, a Somali-American living in San Diego, who, according to the NSA, was found via the phone metadata program, and he was ultimately convicted of sending $8,500 to the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. So that's a real conviction for material support for terrorism, but that is not, I don't think anyone would argue, a terrorist plot that has been thwarted. It's a catching a guy who is sending $8,500 to Al-Shabaab.
Mm-hmm.
Another example involves David Coleman Headley, who was an American involved in the Mumbai terrorist attacks. And according to the NSA, a subsequent attack that he was planning on a Dutch newspaper was stopped with the help of NSA surveillance. One of my colleagues, Sebastian Rotella, who has been covering the Mumbai case and Headley for a long time, looked at that and determined that the real thing that broke that case was a tip from British intelligence, not NSA surveillance. And finally, a group of men in Kansas City were convicted again of material support for terrorism for sending money to Yemen. The NSA came out and said that those same men were actually also planning an attack on the New York Stock Exchange, but they were never charged with that. According to court filings in their case, it was one of these things where they were Googling around for New York Stock Exchange. Again, I think hard to call that a plot that was thwarted. Those are the four episodes that they have gone public with. So I think that's sort of an important piece of context that outlets should consider including or at least keeping in mind when they're quoting this number.
Some might say, well, if this metadata collection even partially thwarted a partial plot, that's good enough.
Sure. And I mean, if that's the argument that people want to make, I think it's a completely legitimate argument and that's a debate that can be had on the merits. I just think you have to have an agreed upon set of facts about the actual record here to have that debate in an informed way.
Justin, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Justin Elliott is a reporter for ProPublica.
Coming up, the feds come looking for a potato launcher and end up leaving with the reporter's notes.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform designed to provide a simple way to create a website, portfolio, or online store for business or personal use. Squarespace provides templates and drag-and-drop tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready with 24/7 support, domain names, and e-commerce all included on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media. Support for On the Media also comes from The New School, offering graduate programs in media studies and media management. These flexible cross-disciplinary programs are designed to carefully balance theory and practice so students are fully engaged with current media scholarship, as well as the latest tools of media production and management. The programs can be completed on campus in New York City, online, or in a combination of on-campus and online study. More information about the New School's graduate programs in media studies and media management is available at newschool.edu/media NYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Lately, we've put our focus on the issue of opacity at the Department of Homeland Security and the agencies it controls, specifically its impact on speech, privacy, and civil rights. So we offer now another case where a search and seizure go unexplained. In August, the Coast Guard, a DHS agency, along with the Maryland State Police, arrived at a reporter's home with a search warrant authorizing a weapons search. They left with a heap of the reporter's work documents and notes. Now, search warrants are narrowly tailored so that the authorities may only look for evidence or contraband specifically outlined in the warrant, or items that are explicitly illegal. None of that appears to have applied in this case. Here's the reporter, Audrey Hudson, who has written for conservative news outlets like The Washington Times and Newsmax.
The search warrant at 4:30 in the morning that they presented was to locate a potato launcher or a potato gun. It sounds more nefarious than it really is. Basically, it's a novelty item.
You fire potatoes?
Correct. It was junk, and my husband had thrown it out like a week after he bought it.
He had had some kind of scuffle before with authorities, right?
27 years ago, my husband had been charged with resisting arrest. Basically, the police say that because of something that happened 27 years ago, that I can't have guns. I'm registered in Maryland. I own guns for my protection,
mm-hmm.
as well as my amusement. I like guns. You know, I'm a Kentucky girl. I come kitchen trained and firearm ready.
But the warrant merely specified looking for the potato gun that had been discarded five yes. years earlier.
The purpose of the warrant was to search our premises for this potato gun.
Describe the event itself.
Well, it was about 4:30 in the morning. My husband, he'd already left for work. And my dog starts barking like crazy, and I look out the window, and we're literally surrounded with all of these SUVs and I could see the men advancing towards the house were wearing full body armor. It was clear they were the police. A moment later, the phone rang, and it was my husband on his cell phone, and he said, "The police are here. Put the dog away and open the door." He was already out of the driveway and down the street, and they pulled him over and brought him home. I know it's crazy, but our first thought was, please, God, don't let them shoot our little schnauzer.
So you put the dog in a room, and you opened the door when they rang, and...
And in they came. They presented us with a search warrant. The officer who works at the Coast Guard asked me if I was the same Audrey Hudson who had written all those air marshal stories for the Washington Times.
That was about 10 years ago, and the stories were critical of the U.S. Air Marshal program.
That is correct.
Right.
And he identified himself as a former air marshal official. He mentioned a couple of stories I had written. When they left, they did take my guns and have us sign an inventory sheet. They said on the inventory that they had taken miscellaneous papers from the upstairs office.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was told by the state trooper, and the search warrant allows it, that they were going to take a piece of mail for proof that we resided at this property. I just presumed that that's what it was. A month later, we got a phone call from the same officer that asked me if I was the writer, and he said that I could pick up my files. That's the first I learned that files have been taken, and they pertain to the Federal Air Marshal Service. One document was marked SSI, Sensitive Security Information. That document was an Inspector General report that I had obtained through the Freedom of Information Act,
mm-hmm.
and the letter releasing that report to me was still stapled mm-hmm. to the top of that report. There was another document I had in there, which had official use only, I believe the terminology was. That was actually part of a document released by the House Judiciary Committee that had investigated the Air Marshal Service based on my stories, and they had released the document to me.
Mm-hmm.
The Homeland Security in their statement says that it was legal for me to have these documents. Well, I could have told them, you know, if they'd asked.
And the law says that they can't seize any documents unless they are explicitly illegal. Taking your notebooks was beyond the purview of the law.
They took 5 files of notes, all of them clearly federal air marshal files. I've used a lot of whistleblowers in these air marshal stories, and I'm really scared for my anonymous sources.
The Washington Times, for whom you reported the air marshal pieces, is filing a lawsuit on your behalf. The editor wrote, "While we appreciate the law enforcement's right to investigate legitimate concerns, there is no reason for agents to use an unrelated gun case to seize the First Amendment protected materials of a reporter." Where does that case stand?
I met with the lawyers this week. I am joining with the Washington Times. We're pursuing legal action. Obviously, I can't go into our legal strategy. That is the next step.
Okay, one thing we haven't said is that the implication here is that this search was less about getting your husband's potato gun and more about getting at your reporting notes.
What I can say is that during the search, they got my reporting notes. They didn't get a potato launcher.
Audrey, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Brooke.
Audrey Hudson is a freelance journalist and the Washington correspondent for the Colorado Observer. We asked the Coast Guard for comment. Carlos Diaz, chief of media relations for the Coast Guard, said that according to evidence logs, the documents they took were never shared with TSA, so Audrey's sources needn't worry. An agent reached the TSA to confirm that Hudson legally obtained the documents in question, but their content was never discussed. This seems a fine time to remind you of our new Reach Your Representative tool that we've tweaked since we introduced it last week. It's very simple. Just go to onthemedia.org and you'll see a box for the project marked Shed Light on the Department of Homeland Security, which will connect you pretty much directly with the office of your elected representative. You'll see the questions we want answered about the policies that govern the behavior of the vast network of security agencies under DHS. they won't tell us what those policies are. Maybe they'll tell you. The tweak I mentioned is that when we first launched the tool last week, it connected you with representatives who served on a relevant committee, whether or not you lived in their district. It turned out you got stonewalled if you weren't a voter. So now we'll just connect you directly with your elected representative. So be the reporter and help us shed light on DHS. You'll find the tool at onthemedia.org.
And now a correction and some of your comments. First, the correction. In last week's show, I spoke to Stephanie Mensimer about the case of Jamie Lee Jones, the contractor who claimed to have been gang-raped while working for a Halliburton subsidiary in Iraq. Mensimer blamed the media, herself included, for reporting Jones' story uncritically and then not following up when evidence of her lies emerged. Mensimer credited the Houston Chronicle with a great follow-up, but noted that the Chron did not actually cover the trial in its own backyard. Now that correction, which comes from Chronicle reporter Michael Tolson, the guy who did that great follow-up. He wrote that, in fact, the paper did cover the trial, with 7 stories from opening arguments to the verdict. But Tolson went on to praise Mensimer's reporting, adding that whether in the Jones case or the Duke LaCrosse uproar before that or the Tawana Brawley affair before that, quote, accusation is not evidence. Michael, thank you very much.
Last week, I spoke with Brian Krebs about the Experian data breach and the selling of our personal data. We got a lot of comments and tweets, mostly along the lines of this one from a commenter calling himself John E. Reut, who wrote, quote, just listened to the latest On the Media podcast. Now I'm off to curl up in a fetal position under the bed and shake for a few hours. Journalist and Pando Daily editor Adam Pennenberg did what many listeners seem to think is the ultimate nightmare. He challenged hackers to hack into all of his personal information.
So I reached out to a computer security firm, TrustWave. They have an ethical hacking department.
And they said, well, this is interesting. Normally we do corporations. We don't usually do individuals, but we'll give it a go.
That's what they said. It's different for an individual because, as they put it, well, you offer far fewer attack vectors.
What a compliment.
Very sexy. But it turns out, you know, if you're going to hack a company, it just takes fooling one employee to do something and then getting that access to the network and then being able to leverage your access. But for an individual, it's a little bit different.
The rules you laid down for them, your kids were off limits and they shouldn't do anything illegal. But your wife was not off limits.
Well, I wish I had said she was off limits, and so does she at this point.
Take us through the steps that they went through to get into your life.
First thing they did is they did what I would do as a reporter, which is pull up every piece of information that's out there. Over the course of my career, I certainly have divulged information that would be useful for their mission. So, for example, I use Macintosh computers. I have for many years. When they create software code called malware, they usually do it for PCs because most corporations run on PCs. So now they had to actually code malware for me. They couldn't just use something they've used in the past.
So they created a chart, some 9 different ways to penetrate your life. One of them was to try and infiltrate your office at New York University.
They thought about it, but there was a security guard, and again, they can't break the law, and so they didn't come upstairs. But they did send a 3-man team to stake out the front of my apartment, and they spent a lot of time there. And they also moved over to a local park where they had a bird's-eye view of my front stoop with binoculars from a park bench, which sounds really creepy, watching my wife and me come and go. They wanted to sniff my Wi-Fi network, and so they bring their fancy tools to do that, and they realized there are 1,200 wireless networks in a 1/10 of a mile radius of my apartment.
Yeah.
Which, that must be another story there.
So then they tried to infiltrate your wife's Pilates studio.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Do I have to?
Yes.
They tried to get her to open up a fish. They did that to me, too. They would send email to me. And it was very fine-tuned email, not like some of those fish scams you get where you can tell it's a scam.
Like, it wasn't from a Nigerian prince. When they tried to fish you, they'd created an aspiring journalism student in Cincinnati who wanted you to look at her stuff. And when they fished your wife, they created a Pilates instructor in San Francisco who was moving to New York and interested in your wife's operation.
Exactly. And it, just at that time, she was looking for someone. And so the person wrote a very nice note, knew about my wife's studio, and asked whether there were any job openings. And my wife responded, well, maybe, yes. And she sent her a link to a video. And that video link was, it turned out, malware. And when my wife clicked on it, it ended up giving them access to her computer.
What did they get?
Buried in that hard drive was some of my old files.
Because it used to be your computer.
Well, I had given her a computer many years ago. The thing was that I never bothered to wipe my old hard drive when I'm giving it to my wife. I just gave her my old computer. I used to keep some passwords on there. And by looking at old passwords, they were able to then figure out, well, we'll just try all these different combinations of passwords. And ultimately, they cracked all of my passwords very quickly. And they were able to crack my Amazon password, and so they ordered 100 plastic spiders to be delivered to my door. Their company is called Spider Labs, which was pretty funny. And also, they cracked my Twitter account. They posted a very funny message for those who know me. It says, I love Stephen Glass. I was the one who broke the Stephen Glass story many years ago. And so to people who know me, they were shocked on Twitter. Like, you? You love Stephen Glass? What are you talking about? I think the big weakness here are passwords. If you're like me, you have dozens of passwords that you need to use. Well, how do I remember them? Oh, well, I could store them in a file on my computer. Well, that's not a good idea, is it, as we learned in my experience. So what are we supposed to do then to keep track of all these passwords that we need to have with us to access all these services?
What about these password management apps? The Times had an article on it just a couple of weeks ago. They generate more complicated passwords and store them in an encrypted site. They can automatically enter the passwords if you're doing a credit card purchase. What about that?
I don't know. That may be a great idea. I have a feeling, though, that whatever someone comes up with, someone will figure out a way to beat it.
This is how these interviews always end, Adam, with you're incredibly vulnerable and there isn't a damn thing you can do about it. I mean, surely we can do better than that.
You would think. I can't say. I do think that it takes great skill to do what these guys did and to go after an individual, which took a lot of manpower and time. It's not the kind of thing that's scalable, so to speak. It's not something you can automate and make it easy to do. And I don't think that I'm a big enough target, personally.
So then the real answer here is to remain unremarkable, obscure.
You know, security by obscurity is the old motto.
Adam, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Adam Pennenberg is the editor of Pando Daily and author of the new Play at Work, How Games Inspire Breakthrough Thinking.
Coming up, more ways to mess us up with misdirection and tall tales.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform designed to provide a simple way to create a website, portfolio, or online store for business or personal use. Squarespace provides templates and drag-and-drop tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready with 24/7 support, domain names, and e-commerce all included on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Okay, so drop everything you're doing and just wire me $2,000. Don't worry, I just need to get access to a vast fortune left to me by a distant relative who just happens to be a Nigerian prince. I promise that when I get the money, you will get a big cut. An oft-told tale, that one, the notorious Nigerian email scam. Seems like a product of the internet, but actually it is just the latest iteration of a con game dating back centuries. Case in point, the Spanish prisoner scheme, prominent in the 19th century during the Napoleonic Wars. In that scam, the letters, though often penned by con men in Britain, seemed to have come from Spain. The letter recipient was entreated to send funds to a man imprisoned or otherwise confined, who would use the money to get access to his fortune. Once he did that, he vowed to share the wealth with his benefactor. Robert Whitaker is a PhD candidate in the Department of History at the University of Texas at Austin. He wrote about Spanish prisoner letters for the history journal The Appendix. My esteemed PhD candidate Whitaker, my most enthusiastic salutations of the day.
Thanks, and to you too.
Your favorite in this genre is one you found written by a person who called himself Luis Ramos. What was his pitch?
Yeah, so Luis is stuck in the military fortress in Barcelona, or so he claims.
I have been condemned by my political enemies to 16 years of penal servitude that I must extinguish in this fortress, where I am suffering so bitterly that I am deprived of all communication outside, even with my daughter.
He's come to know their address either by looking up obituary notices or by looking in the phone book. And he's offering up his marks, £37,000, in return for some help with some legal fees. He's offering up also his 14-year-old daughter. He wants the mark to care for this child.
You're talking about his target, his sucker.
That's right, yes.
And it worked?
Well, it depended. He's writing in a pre-internet age, and so he doesn't really have a good sense as to where his marks are actually located. In some cases, he sends it to the wrong address. There are several cases where Ramos actually sent a letter to somebody who'd been dead for a number of years. In some cases, also, Ramos got the name of the potential mark incorrect. For instance, instead of writing to Mr. Harry Robinson, he wrote to Mr. Robertson Harry and said that he knew Mr. Robertson Harry through his wife, Mrs. Mary Harry.
You mentioned the internet. When we're speaking of Nigerian cons, those email blasts go to millions and millions of people, of whom one might likely be enough of a sucker to bite. The handwritten Spanish prisoner letters couldn't have reached more than a handful of prospective victims. How in the world could these things have paid off?
Even though Ramos had to do more work in order to try to get that money, this was his profession, right? He was a career criminal. You know, what's amazing about Ramos's letters is that they're so well crafted. In addition to the actual letter, he also supplies supporting documents, evidence that he's actually in prison and that his story is true. The initial notice of arrest for Ramos, newspaper articles saying that Ramos has been arrested. And then also eventually, because of the nature of the Ramos drama, it also includes Ramos's death certificate.
Now, the Spanish prisoner goes back at least a couple hundred years. Going back only a century, you say that the early part of the 20th century saw a huge surge in this scam.
Well, one of the main reasons why it happened was because Spain in particular, the origin point for most of these letters, was going through a major period of political disruption, first caused by the Spanish-American War at the beginning of the 20th century, but then also leading up to the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s. And going along with this kind of political upheaval was a favorite trick for these Spanish prisoners. They write their own stories, borrowing from the headlines, making it seem like they and the reader were playing a part in this political drama going on in Spain. Another reason why this con became more common at the beginning of the 20th century was because, in particular in Britain, you saw the publication of Who's Who. This is kind of a progenitor of modern-day Facebook, where the British elite would apply to being a Who's Who, and they would share their personal details and also include their addresses. So one of the later con artists that I look at, by the name of Vicente Olivier, used a copy of Who's Who to send Spanish prisoner letters to the British elite during the 1930s and 1940s.
I am taking the greatest chance of my life in trusting you such a delicate matter as this, but the strange and unfortunate position in which fate has placed me has compelled me to trouble you. I cannot count on friends or acquaintances, because the majority of them became my enemies since my disgrace, and I do not wish them to know my terrible predicament. Neither I know which one to trust, so I decided to trust you all my secret. Depending on your loyalty and absolute discretion, and imploring that you realize my situation and save me.
we tend to think of scams like this as something that bubbles up and then everybody gets wise to them and then they just sort of vanish from the face of the earth. But no, the Spanish prisoner con is a steady state. Why is that?
Well, my argument is that people are attracted to easy money, but also they're looking for a good emotion, a compelling story, right? You're receiving this letter from a desperate person, either in prison or somehow else indisposed, and it's up to you, you alone, to help them. And, you know, in many of these cases, the prisoner is not only talking about their own life, but also the life of maybe a loved one, like a 14-year-old daughter. And so I think in many cases, it's not so incredible to believe that somebody would buy into this scam because they get caught up in the emotions and the drama of the story presented by the criminal.
Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robert Whitaker is a PhD candidate at the University of Texas.
Last year, Cormac Hurley of Microsoft Research wrote a paper called Why Do Nigerian Scammers Say They're From Nigeria? We spoke to Daniel Simons, who wrote about the paper for the Wall Street Journal.
Well, what Cormac Hurley did was envisioned what the scam would be like from the scammer's perspective, and he applied a mathematical tool called signal detection theory to take a look at why it might benefit the scammers to send messages that were so obviously spam. The interesting insight is that what the spammers need to do is filter out people who aren't gullible enough. They need to filter out the people who might respond but wouldn't, in the end, send them any money. It takes the scammers quite a bit of time and effort to reel in the suckers. They have to send repeated emails. They have to prolong the scam, making them become more and more comfortable with the idea of wiring large amounts of money to them, and try and limit their time and effort to those people who are most likely to give them money. So one of the best ways to do that is to make the scam obvious enough that anybody who has any ounce of skepticism won't participate. Signal detection originally was applied to hearing, right? So can you detect that very faint beep when you go for a hearing test? If your hearing were perfect, you'd say, yeah, I heard the beep every time there was a beep. And you'd say, no, there was no beep every time there wasn't a beep. But it turns out we tend to sometimes think that something is present when it's not, and we sometimes miss something when it's actually there.
And so in the case of these scammers,
the gullible people are the beeps, right? And all the people who respond but never send them money, they're the absence of a beep that they think is a beep. They don't care about beeps that they don't hear because they can send out millions of emails. And if they miss a few targets, so what? What they want to make sure they do is eliminate those cases where they think they've got a sucker and they don't.
So how many people are falling prey?
There's been at least one analysis by a Dutch security firm called Ultrascan that estimates that these advanced fee scams, scams where they try and get you to send some money, in 2009 the estimate was $9.3 billion, and it's increasing.
In 2008, it was $6.3, so that's, a 50% increase?
Yeah, it's a pretty big increase. And the scammers are actually getting more sophisticated. There was a recent article in the Wall Street Journal about targeting lawyers, law firms, with this sort of an advanced fee scam. It's an interesting approach because law firms are used to dealing with potential clients over the internet, and they often act as an intermediary between a client and a larger company that needs to pay them. And these law firms that are sending money are gullible. They're not thinking twice about why they're wiring $500,000 to Hong Kong. They're not thinking twice about checking whether this cashier's check is legitimate, or they're not thinking carefully from the scammer's perspective about how they could pull off the scam. They call the number that was provided by the client rather than calling the bank directly. So these scams are targeting people who maybe are going to be less skeptical because it is exactly the sort of thing they deal with on a day-to-day basis.
There have been a lot of efforts to counter these scams, you know, educating people, tweaking software that can filter or detect the scams. But you and Mr. Hurley suggest that the solution is actually counterintuitive.
Yeah, you might think that the best way to avoid these scams is to educate people so that they don't fall prey to them. And you don't want somebody in your company to fall for this scam. The best thing you can do is educate them so that they don't respond to these emails. But if you want to stop the scammers more broadly, the interesting approach you can take is to reverse the process, increase the noise for them. And it's called scam baiting, where you respond as if you're going to play along, and then you play along as you can, but don't actually send in money.
So I have to assume that eventually the Nigerian prince scams are going to go away because every single person will know that it's phony. I have to assume that's why all those penis enlargement ads are no longer in my mailbox.
The scam won't necessarily go away. There are always going to be some gullible people who are new to the internet who haven't really heard of this particular scam before. That's actually a very effective technique for them because it filters out the people who are aware of the scam. And the only people who are going to respond are the people who are unaware of it, and there always are going to be some of them.
Daniel, thank you so much.
Sure thing. My pleasure.
Daniel Simons is a professor in the Department of Psychology and the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology at the University of Illinois.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
The cops, look out there! Stand back!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute. Something wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another one and another one. They look like tentacles to me.
As you've no doubt heard, the 75th anniversary of War of the Worlds passed earlier this week. And you recall, of course, that Orson Welles' 1938 radio play about a Martian invasion set off a mass national panic. Here's Welles in a press conference following that broadcast.
You might have taken advantage of the public.
I simply don't know. I can't imagine an invasion from Mars would find ready acceptance.
We are speaking of gullibility on an epic scale. But according to University of Maine journalism professor Michael Sokolow, the gulls weren't the radio listeners of 1938. They are us. Sokolow and co-author Jefferson Pooley wrote in Slate this week, there was no widespread freakout over the Mercury Theater on the Air broadcast. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So let's start with who all heard the War of the Worlds episode when it was actually broadcast back in 38.
We don't really know. We don't have, you know, accurate numbers, but there were two surveys done that are particularly important. One was done the night during the show, and it found that 98% of the listening audience was listening to something else or didn't have their radio on. And then there was a CBS survey done the next morning that also showed that barely anybody heard it and that those who did hear it knew it was a drama.
But there was a particular piece of scholarship that helped advance and perpetuate the myth. Tell me about Hadley Cantrill.
He was running the Princeton Radio Research Project when this incredible story occurred. His book called The Invasion from Mars is very slim on the actual data, and it's filled with these sensationalistic, lurid accounts of people telling him these narratives of fright. Cantrill himself is clear about the limitations of his study. Okay, so he does say there were over 12,000 newspaper articles that they had in this research project, and they tried to track down names from the research article, and they found less than six people. The problem is people bought his book like crazy because it validates the panic.
Banner headlines about this mass panic. Where did those reports come from, and how did they wind up getting that much play?
The reports came from newsrooms that didn't have much news. It was the day before Halloween. But the second place they came from is the context of something called the press radio war in the 1930s. During that decade, newspapers were dying off. They were losing a lot of advertising revenue. The newspaper owners and the newspaper industry did not like the radio industry, which was growing and gaining a lot of business at their expense. For years, these two industries had been fighting. You had economic and business power all shifting towards radio. When this opportunity occurred, newspapers had something to attack radio's credibility that they had never had before. In certain areas, the telephone exchanges did get flooded. I'm not saying that didn't happen. And people did call the police. I'm not saying that didn't happen. But, you know, the question you have to ask is that reaction rational or irrational? Is that panic? What do you do when you hear something you're not sure about? You check up on it. And so we don't know what happened in those telephone calls. We can't assume that everybody was scared out of their wits.
Let's say it was sensationalized. How did it survive the aftermath of that news cycle?
The story actually makes us feel good. We feel superior to that audience. We're smart enough. We're critical enough. We never would have fallen for this. But it makes us feel good in the same way when, for instance, the Chinese media picks up a humorous story from The Onion and plays it straight. I mean, this has been studied by media scholars for a long time, that we all believe that other people are a lot more persuadable in the media than we are.
This story came up in our story meeting based on your article, and I was shocked because I myself have accepted the notion of mass panic. And I have heard, seen, or read probably hundreds of stories about it, which means at least hundreds of times in the last 75 years, journalists have missed the opportunity to bring to bear any journalistic skepticism and due diligence, which bespeaks mass professional failure. Should I not be in despair over this?
No. CBS has never released their data on it. Why? Because this is about the power of the media. The media industry is premised on the idea that we can persuade people to behave in certain ways. This story is the greatest illustration of that.
You believe that there is a kind of institutional conspiracy on the part of all broadcast media?
No, I would say it in the following way, that the broadcast industry, and I'm including here broadcast advertising, make certain assumptions about the powers they have over the mass audience that align perfectly with this story. I don't think it's conscious of them to cover up the idea of what happened. I think they believe it happened.
Now, just in the past few days on PBS and from WNYC's own Radio Lab, you heard stuff about the War of the Worlds so-called panic that you know not to be true. It persists.
It persists for a very simple reason. Both Radiolab and PBS chose to use a piece of scholarship from 1940 to base their program upon. Think about this for a second, Bob. If you were to make a documentary today about the Civil War or the Jazz Age, don't you think you'd use newer scholarship than from 1940?
Now, there's one other interpretation of these events, and I must run it past you. I saw it in a comment on an NPR news blog by a listener whose handle is Frisco John. And he sees things slightly differently. I quote, "This is all part of a massive campaign of disinformation from our current Martian overlords. Long live the resistance." Your thoughts?
I'd just like, for the record, to say I love that I've been attacked as part of a Martian conspiracy, but I'm really from the Sea of Tranquility.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Sokolow is an associate professor of communication and journalism at the University of Maine. And here's a statement from the producer of American Experience, the PBS show he criticized, quote, "The producers drew on a wide range of scholarship through interviews with several historians and cultural critics. We did make a very conscious nod to the work others have done. Hadley Cantrill's reputable research has been a primary source for many who have written on the broadcast, and we saw no compelling reason not to use it." Radiolab said, quote, "We'll be including an interview with Sokolow in our hour, and we're excited to include his perspective."
Here's 50s talk show host Steve Allen explaining that he and his aunt and mother briefly believed the broadcast was real while at a hotel in Chicago.
Then we burst into the lobby, which to our great surprise was absolutely calm. People reading, smoking cigars, dozing in the chairs by the potted palms. And something immediately told me that that was inconsistent with the end of the world.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Zach Spencer and Megan Tehan, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Rick Kwan.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.